All right. That was Democracy Now!, brought to you every weekday from 4 to 5 p.m. And next, coming up on Wednesdays at 5, is my show called Doing Democracy. I'm Victoria. And if you need to send me a message, you can send an email to doingdemocracyradio@gmail.com. And I need to remind you that the views and opinions expressed on my show are mine or those of my cited sources and were not chosen by WRUW or by Case Western Reserve University. Today I'm going to play part of the talk that was given by David Cobb last Friday, July 2nd. At the Universalist Unitarian Church in Cleveland Heights, and I saw lots of familiar faces there, so hopefully you'll get a chance to hear him again. So we'll start that in a minute. I want to just play a few voices from a tribute to the victims of Chernobyl, just sort of a tribute to the survivors of the tragedy down in the Gulf. And just needed to do that. So here are a few voices from Chernobyl, a tribute.
We were all ordered to leave on the third day. During the day, we lived in the new place, and at night, we lived back at home in Chernobyl, in our dreams.
You can resettle people, but the elk, the boar, you can't. And water, it doesn't listen to borders. It goes along the earth and under the earth.
How do you resettle a pigeon or a sparrow? How do you evacuate all the animals in the earth, the bugs and the worms?
There's nowhere to hide. Not underground, not underwater, not in the air. Chernobyl is like the war of all wars.
The soldiers cleaning the roof got it the worst. They had lead vests, but the radiation was coming from below. They were wearing ordinary, cheap imitation leather boots. They spent 2 minutes on the roof each day and were discharged, given a certificate and 100 rubles. And then they disappeared.
Who would dive into that water and open the safety valve? They promised them a car, an apartment, a dacha, aid for their families until the end of time. These people don't exist anymore.
The blackened faces of the firemen, like graphite. These were the eyes of the people who already knew they were leaving us.
I moved concrete. We didn't take any gas masks. Out in radioactive dust 8 hours a day. Everyone got paid well, 3 times your salary plus vacation pay. They flung us there like sand on the reactor. They gave me 1,000 rubles and a medal.
They picked up the earth and rolled it like big rugs. The whole green mass of it with grass, flowers, roots, bugs, spiders, worms. It was work for madmen. You can't just pick up the whole earth, take off everything living. They buried earth in earth.
If a soldier got more than 25 rentgens of exposure, his superiors could be put in jail for poisoning their men. So no one got more than 25 rentgens. You understand? This level of lying, this incredible level with which Chernobyl is connected in our minds, was like the level of lies during the big war.
I was one of the soldiers who fought in Afghanistan. When I made it back from there, I knew I would live. In Chernobyl, it was the opposite. It would kill you only after you got home.
The graves of the Chernobyl firefighters who died and were buried near Moscow. People walk around them and don't bury their relatives nearby. Even the dead fear these dead.
After I die, my husband told me, sell the car and don't marry Tolik. Tolik was his brother. I did not marry Tolik.
Gives me chills. That was just part of a CBC production that kindly was given to me by Joe. Joe is one of my great volunteer citizen media people who gives me great recordings. And I welcome them from any of you out there, and or any other suggestions. And Joe also made a recording of the event on Friday with David Cobb, and I did also, and I'm going to play, I think, my version. And don't have too high expectations about the quality of these homemade recorders by citizen media types. We're trying to do our job, and as you know, and as highlighted by the BP segment before on Democracy Now!, there's so much that they don't want us to see, and I have my little tape recorder, and I've snuck it into courthouses and other places, and I think it's a good thing for all of us to have. I do want to read, just before I start with David Cobb, I want to read part of a timeline that was actually in the building where he was giving his talk. This is a timeline of personhood, rights, and powers. And I just want to highlight a couple of things about it that relate to the BP situation. As you know, corporations were, well, maybe you don't know, but corporations were given the right that are afforded to persons when they were declared persons, corporate persons. And with that, they receive the rights of people, one of which is the Fourth Amendment search and seizure protection. In the 1906 Hale versus Hinkle, corporations got the Fourth Amendment search and seizure protection. Justice Harlan disagreed on this point and said, "The power of the government by its representatives to look into books, records, and papers of a corporation of its own creation to ascertain whether that corporation has obeyed or is defying the law will be greatly curtailed, if not destroyed." And just think about that in the context of BP and so many other crisis tragedies that occur because of negligence is the kindest thing I can say. So here's David Cobb, and hope you enjoy his talk given on the 2nd of July.
And I'll tell you, this is not just a sort of a chuckle line. This is my best effort to describe my political, emotional state of being. Because I can remember what it was like as a little boy when I was so proud to be an American. Because I was from the land of the free and the home of the brave. Because I was from the land of liberty and justice and equality. And if that wasn't enough, my country was going to be like the great shining light on the hill. And it was going to be bringing liberty and justice and equality all across the world. And I was so proud to be from that country. Excuse me. I can still remember what that feels like as a little boy to actually be proud of your country and what it's supposed to stand for. And I don't think as a very young boy that I particularly understood exactly the complexities of all that. But what I did know, that it was meant that America was a place of justice and fairness and compassion. And, you know, the reason I'm so angry is because when I grew up, I realized I had been lied to. That it was not true. And I don't think that Mrs. Armstrong, my fifth grade teacher, sat up at night and said, "I can't wait till those little children come into my room and I can tell them lies and work their minds and maybe I'll make bones from their bread." Bread from their bones. That wasn't what was going on. She believed it too. And frankly, I'd be willing to bet if we had enough time for conversations, most of you in this room believed it too. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, do you remember feeling like that?
Yes.
Man, I want to feel like that again. I want to feel like that again. Because what happened when I grew up and went to college, and isn't that interesting, by the way, at going through junior high and even high school? American history is not really taught to you. What happens is discrete sort of stories, all doing their best to decontextualize it so you don't actually get that narrative arc about what's going on. For me, maybe some of y'all were lucky enough to like have a high school teacher who said, "This book is by Howard Zinn. It's called The People's History. Read this." You know, maybe you were lucky enough. I've heard about people who actually were exposed to Zinn in high school. I didn't get exposed to Zinn until college. And frankly, it wasn't just Zinn, but it was a number of different academics who actually laid out the history of the United States and really put not only, like, it's not just that there were Indians here, it's that there were vibrant civilizations here that were subject to genocide. And that was actually the founding of my country. And that my country was built actually on slavery. And that women in my country were subjected to brutal exploitation, repression, and oppression throughout the history of this country, for most of the history of this country. And man, that is a tough thing to grapple with. Peel away the layer of the onions and all of the assumptions that you were taught. But what I have recognized is the reason that we're taught that lie, let's call it what it really is, a creation myth. There's a reason the elites tell that creation myth, by the way. Because we want to believe it. And by the way, it's not just a myth that Americans want to believe. Human beings want to believe that. Whether you're in the United States, or Mexico, or Kenya, or Slovakia, or anywhere else that human beings gather together, everybody actually wants to be in some sort of community where you're caring for one another and creating a society that you want to live in. Isn't that something? Right? And it's interesting, too. I had a college history professor who once acknowledged that, you know, I actually prefer getting students who have not actually been exposed to too much history in junior high and high school, because I don't have to deconstruct as much with them. Can you imagine any mathematics teacher saying, "Man, I hope that you didn't get exposed to algebra or basic mathematics"? I mean, the reality is we're in a place of worship here. My grandfather's a Baptist preacher. I'm going to invoke something that we do in my tradition, truth telling. Can I have permission to tell the truth as I see it? Even if you may not agree with everything, may I at least say my truth to you?
This is a Unitarian society. You can say anything.
Thank you, brother. He said, "This is a Unitarian church. You can say anything you want here." So here is part of my truth. The United States of America is a racist, sexist, and class-oppressive society. We are destroying the planet upon which we depend for survival, and we are taking the plunder of that earth, creating that racist society, and then, to add insult to injury, salt to the wound, sort of like poking our finger in the eye as we march down that cliff that we're about to fall over, we're told, "But this is a democracy, but this is a democracy, this is the democracy, people chose it. No, that's my second truth. The United States of America is not now, it has never been, nor was it designed to be an actual functioning democracy. And that, for a lot of people, is a hard thing to accept. But folks, stay with me, because if you actually accept that, then the third truth that I want to tell you will be easier, and that is the entire history of the United States has been a history of struggle by ordinary people fighting against the elite, against the powerful, against all odds, at making this country a more fair place, a more just place, a more compassionate place, a more democratic place. That is our history, and that is our legacy. Here's a little pop quiz. How many people here genuinely believe that you are actively participating in creating the society in which you live? Actively participating in the real? Now raise your hand if you do. Alright, so we got several people who raise their hand. That's great. And I hope that we'll get a chance to actually talk about that, because I don't really think that we have real power. Because I don't think corporations are merely exercising power in our society. I think corporations are ruling us. I think that they are making those fundamental public policy decisions that affect their our lives. And we are left to choose between paper or plastic at the grocery store. We can certainly choose between Coke or Pepsi. We can make all kinds of material choices. But when it comes down to the real thing about how much wealth is going to be distributed in this society, that is nowhere on the table. When it comes time to whether or not this country goes to war or not, we the people are never consulted. When it comes time to how are we going to transition against using fossil fuels as an energy source, that is burning the planet. There's never an opportunity to engage in that. Here's another pop quiz. How many of you in this room right now are eating genetically mutated organisms? Raise your hands if you are. Yeah, this is the problem, sir. It's a Unitarian crowd, so everybody raise their hand. Y'all spoiled my punchline, which is everybody. Why? Because it's in our public food supply. You can't not eat it. Now, here's a question. If something is in our public food supply and such an important public decision like that, how many of you actually went down to the Cleveland City Council where it was debated and ultimately decided to allow genetically mutated organisms into the Cleveland food supply? How many of you people went down there? It's a trick question, right? Because there were no such hearings. All right. How many of y'all went to Columbus when the state legislature in Ohio was going to decide to allow that to happen? It's another trick question. All right. How many of y'all went to Washington, D.C. or tuned in to C-SPAN or CNN when the Congress was debating whether to allow GMOs to first come on? Don't raise your hands, because that's a trick question, too. The reality is that the United States Congress only began to hold hearings after the fact. And those hearings were, should it be labeled or not? You know, in Latin America and in Europe, you know what the fight is? Get rid of it. There's a part of me that says we in the United States as citizens have become a little cowed. We have become a little complacent. You know, when the fight, if you care about GMOs in your food supply and your real frame, your own frame, you decide what you're going to fight over is label it. I'd like to talk to you. Raise your aspirations a little bit. Be for what you're for. Don't make compromises before the fight even begins. And I'll be honest with you. My friend Bill Price and I have been in a lot of different fights, mostly around environmental stuff. We do make compromises after we've engaged the fight. Right, Bill?
Yeah, maybe.
If y'all want to know about somebody who don't really like to compromise at all, meet Bill Price. Let me ask you this, Bill. Do we start compromising with ourselves before we even engage the bad guys? No, we do not do that. And so I guess what I'm getting at is the genetically mutated organism issue is telling because that decision, clearly with public import, was made behind closed doors. They claimed it was a private corporate decision that we the people were not allowed to participate in. In fact, we weren't allowed to know about it. Think about that for a minute. We didn't even know it was happening until after the fact. How did it come to this? I mean, isn't this a democracy where we the people rule? Isn't like, that's what I remember being told. Well, the problem, again, is that we have a social, political, and legal system that is designed to prevent our participation. The word democracy, what language does it come from?
Greek.
Can anybody break it down? Demos kratia? Demos means? The people. Kratia? Power or rule. It's exactly interchangeably in Attic Greek. So it means the people rule. I don't believe that we really rule in this country as a collective group of people. You know, and that's actually a problem because we're promised a democratic republic. That's what we're supposed to have. That's the creation myth. And frankly, we could do the same thing that we just did with GMOs about virtually every institution in this society. I will submit this to you. Unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are basically making the decisions about what transportation choices will be available for us as a people. Unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are making the fundamental decisions on how much health care we're going to have access to and basically how much it's going to cost. Unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are making the energy choices in this country. Literally, they are making all of the big decisions And frankly, even our elected officials are going cap in hand to them and are either complicit with it, either bought and paid for it, except for a few. And since we're in Ohio, can I say, God bless Dennis Gusevich. God bless Dennis Gusevich for being one of those politicians who continues to stand up and fight against corporate power. Man would have made a fine president of the United States.
They wouldn't let him.
Very well. I got a very quick story. I was actually on a stage with about 1,000 screaming campus greens in 2004 when I had just won the Green Party's presidential nomination. He was still fighting for the Democratic Party. He's a fighter. He wasn't going to give up. And I told that crowd and Dennis right next to me, I said, you know, I don't believe the Democratic Party leadership and the elites who run the media and run this country are ever going to allow Dennis to earn the Democratic Party's nomination. But I've been wrong about other things, and I'll never fight somebody over differences of tactics. I agree with Dennis Kucinich on 95% of everything, and I said this, if I end up being wrong, Dennis, and you end up the Democratic Party nominee, I'm pledging right now, I'll drop out of the race and work for you to get you elected president. But if I'm right, and they continue to denigrate you and tear you down, Dennis, you should consider joining the Green Party. Fair's fair. I'm just saying, hey, maybe Democrats are right and you end up being able to use the Democratic Party for something good. I don't think you can. I had 15 years of trying to do that. But if you're right and that starts to happen, I'll work with you. I'm proud to work with progressive Democrats. They're getting, in elected office, they're getting harder and harder to find. I'm a rank and file, they're getting easier and easier to find. What the hell is up with that? I mean, if you're going to stay in the Democratic Party, I got news for you. You've got some work to do. Amen. Right? Just saying. So we can, every institution, every decision, we can find that corporate power is right behind it, pulling the string. It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, you know, that's actually in charge of everything. Well, I submit that corporations are the dominant institution of our times. It is the most important, powerful thing that we as humans have ever either created or allowed to be created. So it would behoove us to spend just a little bit of time on understanding just a little bit of the history of the corporation. And I'm going to do it real quick. What language does corporation come from?
Latin.
Yeah, man. Latin. It's Latin. Do you know the definition by chance? Any of you seminarians? Corpus, it means body. And Asian is the state of, or to create. So what it means is to create the state of the body, to create the body. Any lawyers in the crowd? You can admit it. They're Unitarians. They won't be here. Right, nobody here. Listen. In law school, we are taught that a corporation is a legal fiction. Yeah, right? It doesn't really exist, but let's pretend like it does so we can treat it this way under law. The point I'm making is it's that the word corporation means to give body to create something that had not existed before out of whole cloth. But you're not really creating it out of whole cloth, because what happens is you take private monies from lots of different sources and focus it, concentrate it in one place to do something. And in Rome, the first corporations were used to build the aqueducts, you know, that amazing bit of engineering that moved water without a lick of electricity. By the way, maybe we don't have to burn coal to be able to move water around. Just a thought. It was also corporations that were used to build the first hospitals, the first universities, the roads, you know that famous phrase, all roads lead to Rome? Well, it was Roman corporations that built those roads. Does anything strike you as similar about all of those institutions I just named? Roads, hospitals, universities, water systems. They're public goods. They're public works. The reality is the founding, the first use of the corporation as an entity comes very directly, very clearly out of a need to concentrate from lots of individual sources enough capital and resources to do big major public projects. But that's not the birth really of that. So that's
to conceptually frame what a corporation is. The birth of the modern transnational corporation actually comes out of the 13th, 14th, and 15th century of Europe. The age of discovery. Now, for the radio, I am making the invisible quotation signs with my fingers, because that era is not the age of discovery at all, is it? You know why? Because there were people in Africa and Asia and later North and South America. Those people weren't lost. They didn't need to be discovered. Actually, that is the era of rape and pillage and plunder and murder. And I guess that's when I'm going to evoke my request from you that I be allowed to tell the truth. Because that's an ugly truth, but it is an accurate truth. That's actually what was going on during that era. And catch this, the modern corporation was born and created and conceived in order to effectively implement the imperial policies of rape and pillage and plunder. To literally go out, subjugate other peoples, and vacuum out their resources and bring it back to the king, who had created the corporation with a charter, creating corporations like the East India Corporation, the Africa Trading Corporation. Anybody want to guess what the Africa Trading Corporation might have traded?
Slaves,
but this gentleman, I think, framed it better. Because slaves is an abstraction. What did they trade?
Human beings.
Human beings. People like us, by the way. They didn't look like most of us in this room. They didn't look like me because I'm a white person, again, for the radio. But what I will tell you is this. They were people like us because they were human beings. Ask any scientist and they'll tell you, like, pigmentation and skin color is literally one of the most trivial matters of DNA that you can imagine. It's about on the functional equivalent of hair color or eye color or, sad to say for me, hairlines. It's just a genetic thing, right? It's not that big a deal. And here's something else, especially for white folks, hold on here. Scientists tell us race does not exist. Not really. Ethnicity certainly exists. Lots of other genetic things exist. Pigmentation levels exist. But race does not exist. But now, you get ready. Racism most certainly does exist. Whoa! If you can really get your head around that as a white person, then you are finally ready to be a white ally and fight against racism. Because although race doesn't exist, racism does. It is a construct that we have collectively created and actively participate on the day-to-day. And we allow, both institutionally and in our own lives, that racism to play out in ugly ways. And if you as a white person are willing to grapple with that and come to terms with white supremacy and are able to come to terms with what it means in this society to be white and to be benefiting from white skin privilege even if you don't want it, even if you think it's unfair, if you're willing to do that, then I'm here to tell you that there is a whole other workshop that the American Friends Service Committee would like to engage you in. Am I right, Greg Coleridge? And then we can start figuring out ways how to work around this construct that has been created. But I'm going to go back to my story now of the 13th, 14th, 15th century Europe where these entities were created in order to engage in imperialism and jumpstart to the 17th and 18th centuries, where the Americas are discovered, quotation marks with fingers again. Of course, when they came here, there were 500 nations, not tribes, vibrant nations in North and Central America. And the first thing that the king did was to subdivide at arbitrary lines on a map to create how many colonies? 13 colonies. Does anybody want to hazard a guess how many of those colonies were actually created as royal crown charters or corporations?
12.
Say it again. All of them. All of them actually had come from a charter issued by the king in order to plant, rule, and govern in my name. So it was literally an example of the continuation of the rule of the king, the sovereignty of the king. What does sovereign mean?
Rule.
Who rules? And let me tell you, by the way, the king and we're in the 1600s, 1700s now, where does the king get his legitimacy and authority?
God.
Folks, you do not get more legitimate If you really believe, and more importantly, all everybody else around you believes that your authority comes directly from God. If I can convince you, or not even, check this out. If I didn't even need to convince you, if you just walked into this room saying, oh, there's David, he's the king, I guess he'll be telling us what God wants us to do today. Right? That's what it, and the reason that I really underscore that, I challenge you for just one moment to do your best to imagine, to be, use your best visioning and your best imagination, and ask you if you can really imagine actually feeling that or believing that. If you could imagine yourself or anything I might say to you to convince you that that is true. Raise your hand. Wow. One. Two?
If you say it was true, I could imagine.
Oh, you could imagine. I know it ain't true, but I can imagine it. The point of that exercise was to remind us that there was a time only a few hundred years ago when everybody believed that to be true. And so, if you want to live in a world like I do, without war as foreign policy, if you want to live in a world where our economics are actually based on valuing nature and understanding our place within it. If you want to live in a world where the production of goods and services is done in a fair and equitable manner, and the fruit of labor is actually fairly spread, if you want to live in that world, but you think, I can't even imagine it, think about the fact that people just like you, your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, not really that long ago in the grand scheme of history, actually believe that it is the divine right of kings. I say it to really underscore cultural assumptions can change, and they can change drastically. And I think that it's our challenge, actually, to think about how to create the world that we really do want to live in, and begin to imagine those things. So the king creates 13 colonies in order to be little governing institutions and assigns governors. But those governors, really properly understood, are like corporate CEOs, because those are basically corporations. Most of them are actually very explicitly corporations. So it's fair to say that the American Revolution is not just a rejection of monarchy and divine right of kings. It's also a genuine people's uprising against corporate rule. The actions on that these corporate governors were taken. And, you know, we're coming up on July 4th in just a couple of days. The reality is that the Declaration of Independence itself, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all people, sick men, but I'm going to say, that should say that all people are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are powerful words, but actually that's just a very small part of the Declaration. Most of that document is a list of grievances against King George III. And if you go line by line, grievance by grievance, actually most of the things they're grieving about are actions that the corporate governors were taking. Right? It's a very distinct claim that it is illegitimate what these corporate governors on behalf of the king have been doing. And you know, I used to say the American revolutionaries were not calling for a more socially responsible king. And so today, if you want justice, don't ask for more socially responsible corporations. We should be thinking bigger. But what I've discovered is that in the 1730s and 1740s, the people who would later become revolutionaries were, in fact, asking for socially responsible king. They were writing letters that went like this. Dear Father King, we, your humble children, come before you on bended knee and ask that you intervene on our behalf, because Parliament is oppressing us mightily with unfair laws regarding taxation and trade and navigation acts and stamp acts. And Father, will you please intercede on our behalf? We, your humble children, petition you. And in one generation, 25 years, it went from that kind of sniveling, groveling, obsequious language to get out! Off their knees, standing up,
standing up proud, staring at the king who had, in one generation ago, been considered to be God's representative on earth, staring him down as a man and nothing more, and saying, get out, you're not going to rule here anymore, and being willing to stand up to the largest army and empire that the world had ever seen to that point. And what army was and navy was that? It was not the British Army. The greatest concentration of army and navy soldiers assembled at that time was the East India Corporation. And they were an arm and under the direction of the British Empire, to be sure. But they actually, at the start of the war, outnumbered the regular British Army and British Navy. Sort of like, I don't know, Blackwater and Halliburton, run them up.
Were they all British?
No, they were not all British. Good question. So, I'll tell you, as somebody who purports to be and self-identifies as not just a male feminist and a white anti-racist ally, but also as a social change agent, or a non-violent revolutionary, if you will, I will tell you this. I am keenly interested in that thought process from 1740 to 1776. Man, I want to know what kind of conversations were those people having? What kind of plans were they developing? You know, what was their secret handshake? You know, I really think, because I want to replicate that. It is not just rhetoric to me. I declare my independence from corporate rule, and I'm ready to fight. And I would like to, with absolute love in my heart and as much compassion as I muster, declare my interdependence on my fellow human beings and my interdependence on the forests and the rivers and the natural world of which I am a part by birthright. Right? Can we imagine that? So, we know that the American Revolution came into being another entity. And what I'm going to do now is give you, that's sort of the quick, down and dirty history of the birth of the corporation. So, frankly, since we know now that the corporation was, in fact, an entity, an institution that was created in order to engage in empire, murder, pillage, plunder, etc., I'm not surprised when British Petroleum does that or Monsanto does that. I don't think that either Monsanto as an institution or even those men, and they're almost all men, up at the top of it, are actually evil people. I think that we've created institutions and legal systems that basically encourage and support stupid, destructive practices, right? So I'm not surprised when they do that. But, you know, when the king gets kicked out, then a new government gets formed. And what is the supreme law of the land in this country, we're taught? The U.S. Constitution. So what we're going to do very quickly is lay out the framework for how the U.S. Constitution is supposed to operate. How many people have read the Constitution in the last, say, year? I see that gentleman raise his hand in a hurry. Y'all grade my papers and see if you think I more or less do this right. I think that the Constitution, when you read it, actually has, in broad strokes, two main actors. The first, it's how the Constitution began. What are those first three words? We the people. The second construct is government. So you have we the people and government. In this document, we the people are described as free and sovereign. And what does the word sovereign mean? Who rules? Who's in charge? Government is subordinate and accountable. Government is supposed to be subordinate to whom? The people. Government is supposed to be accountable to whom? The people. I like that. It's got a ring to it. This is going well. So, we the people, and government on the other side, we the people are free and sovereign, but government is subordinate and accountable. In this construct, all legitimate power resides with the people. That is to say, all legitimate political power
resides with the people. We the people delegate a certain amount of that power to government, but only a certain amount of it. We're supposed to actually retain most of it. Here is something else. We the people are not supposed to be afraid of our government. And even more, our government is supposed to be afraid of us. We the people are free and sovereign. In this document, we the people are described as having individual rights. Government is described as having collective duties. And check this out. Government is only delegated enough power to specifically do the duties that we want them to do, that we've said that they're going to do. Government is never supposed to assume duties. They are only supposed to be given specific duties by us, the people. And I look at this, and I think, this is brilliant. This is fantastic. I love this because it satisfies my civil libertarian impulses, my don't tread on my me impulses, my, a person's home is their castle, that there are certain things that I can do and I don't have to ask your permission to do it. I have certain rights. And by the way, if I have a right to do something, that means I can do it even if Vicky doesn't want me to do it. If I have a right to do something, I can do it even if all the rest of you don't like it. I don't even need the city of Cleveland's permission. I don't need the state of Ohio's permission. I don't need the federal government's permission. Folks, I'm from the South, and I'm a good Southern boy. If I have a right to do something, I don't even need my mama's permission. That's how serious a right should be considered. Likewise, what does a duty mean? If I owe Vicky a duty under law, it means she can make me do it even if I don't want to do it. Right? And if I'm unwilling to do it or I try to avoid a legal duty to her, she can get the rest of you in society or, if she needs to, the entire power of the state to come and compel me to do it. So the distinction between rights and duties is profound. And let me be very clear about this. Government never has rights over the people. That's not the way this framework is supposed to operate. So I look at this and I think, that is brilliant. I love it because my civil libertarian impulses are satisfied about maintaining my sense of integrity, but it doesn't end there because this document, properly understood, recognizes my communitarian impulses as well. The idea that, yes, I have individual rights, but I'm not alone. That when I step into the body politic and into civil society writ large, that all of a sudden now I have to be operating in a different way. Think of it this way. In the private sphere, I have individual rights that are sacrosanct. But when I am in the public sphere, there are certain communitarian values, certain basic needs. We can disagree about how much that should or should not be, but conceptually, the difference between the private sphere and the public sphere, but the fact that a society needs to acknowledge both. I do love this. I think we should try that in this country. I think this would work. And that's not just a laugh line, because I don't think that we've ever actually had a functioning democracy in the United States. We've never actually applied this, because before I go 1 minute further and wax poetic about the U.S. Constitution, somebody tell me what year the Constitution was either drafted in secret or ratified. Does anybody know? 1789 is the ratification. That's good. 1787 is the convention. 1789 is when it's ratified. Only, by the way, after a Bill of Rights is that.
Oh, yeah.
Worth saying. In 1787 or 1789, who gets to be legally a person with rights under law to be able to participate in this wonderful system?
Why?
All right. First, you said one word?
Landowning.
Men only.
Landowning
men.
Why?
White landowning men.
21.
Had to be 21. You had to be literate in most cases?
Church members?
You had to be a member of the right religion. Yeah, there. Good job. By the way, Unitarians. So, listen. What percentage of the adult human population do you think?
17%,
I've got a guess here.
14. 7.
What are you saying, sir? 5%. The answer is approximately 5 to 7% of the adult population living in the colonies actually was legally a person able to participate fully in this system. And by so this country, honestly, I mean, we got to tell the truth to be able to get through this. So stay with me. But the reality is, the founding of this country, for all the rhetoric and all the beautiful language, the founding of this country is a founding violence. It is a founding violence against the indigenous people who lived here in rich and vibrant civilizations and were subject to intentional, deliberate genocide. It is a founding violence against the African people, not slaves, the African human beings who were brought here on ships, in chains, forced under the lash and the gun and the knife to actually build this country in a state of enslavement. It is a founding violence against women. Because, by the way, women were not legally persons. Women couldn't enter into contracts. Women couldn't vote, much less vote. I mean, they couldn't even own property. Women were property. And women, this is an exercise for the women-only men, so practice doing this sometimes. Just sit down and not talk. As a white man, I try to remind myself. So this is for women only. Please do me the favor of honestly trying to imagine it, like living in a society where not only you could not vote, but you couldn't enter into a contract, you couldn't speak for yourself legally, you could not own property. In fact, you are property. You're basically chattel property, subject to either your father or, if you get married, your husband. And if you don't have a father or a husband, then your brothers or your children, your son, not children, your sons. Is there any woman here today who can like get their heads around that and actually step into that society? Not a single one of you, right? Rarely do I get any woman who does in this presentation. And I just want to remind you, we're only talking about 250 years or so, 300 years, right? That's a very short time period. And again, I say this in order to underscore, cultural assumptions can change. And they can change profoundly when people are willing to engage in the struggle, in the fight, in the desire to change the world. And you know, those women who got together in Seneca Falls, they were at best naive and unrealistic. They were probably crazy to think that they could win. Many people called them dangerous un-Americans. And I think women especially, but all of us who want to live in a more fair society, ought to take a moment and thank those women. Right? Yeah, you can call that. Thank you, guys. Dan Labatt started that applause. Thank you, Dan, because we ought to thank those women, and not just thank them, but to acknowledge them and their legacy for being willing to go through the process of changing cultural assumptions. I say we should try democracy in this country because this concept of a democratic republic was never done. And look, some people might say, all right, Cobb, you got a scathing critique about imperialism and ancient history. But look, we got rid of slavery. Women can vote. It's all fine now. To which I say, no, now it's time to introduce the most dominant institution of the culture, the corporation. Who, do we remember who actually created the initial corporations? The Romans. Through a government system. And then in the 1400s, 1500s, who did it? The king, acting as the sovereign by creating a charter. Right? But we the people are now supposed to be in charge, and government creates the new entity by issuing a charter that says what it could do. Properly understood, a corporation really is a public institution. This is how it's supposed to be operating. And let me walk you through, by the way, the first 75 years of this country, what it took to create a corporation in the new United States of America. First, you had to get a bill introduced in the lower house. Then that same bill had to get passed in the upper house. Then the governor had to sign it. It was the functional equivalent of a law. That's how seriously they took it to give the privilege, not the right, but the privilege. See, incorporating is not a right. It's a privilege that government gives. What does it take, by the way, to... Oh, wait a minute. I'm not finished, because not only did you have to go through the state legislature, in addition to that, you had to explicitly prove that there was a public need that was not being met by existing business or government, and that your new corporation would meet that public need. And if you were granted that charter, the charter was only good for 10 years, at which point it automatically dissolved, and either you or somebody after you had to come along and ask for another corporate charter all over again. And you could only do the specific thing that your charter had been requested for, and you had to pledge to always act in the public interest. And if you were ever found to act outside of the public interest, you were subject to having your corporate charter revoked by either the Attorney General of a state or by a district attorney. The corporate death penalty. Can anybody imagine when now mom and pop corporations could handle that with no problem, because they would be doing that day in and day out. Can anybody imagine a single one of the Fortune 500 big transnational corporations that would be able to meet those requirements today? How about Massey Coal, Bill Price? Nope. How about British Petroleum, folks? Nope. How about Monsanto Corporations, folks? Nope. I'm serious. We could go down that list. And these are not the fantasy of David Cobb or the Green Party or Move to Amend or Progressive Democrats wishing that maybe we could create these. This is our historic legacy. This is what happened in this country for the first 75 years. The point I'm making is the corporation as an instrument was very tightly controlled by the democratic process. That is our legacy. Today, what does it take to create a corporation in the state of Ohio? $175, you fill out some paperwork, boom, you are a limited liability corporation. What are you allowed to do? Anything that is legal under law. That's what it will say, if you fill it out properly. What restrictions are there in how long you can exist?
None!
What restrictions are there in how... what kind of business you might engage in? None! The point is that we have unleashed the corporation from these tethers. And again, you know, so those folks who would say, look, you know, we got rid of slavery, we did all this. The problem is that the corporation is now not just tightly controlled the way it should have been done, because those laws that I just described to you, they began to be lost just leading up to, the time just leading up to, during, and after the Civil War, when the country was actually in chaos. Finally trying to grapple with the most shameful legacy, or one of the most shameful legacies, of slavery, and getting rid of it, right? But during that time period, the country was in such chaos that the wealthy elite, who had been using what institution to amass their power? Slavery, right? I mean, this is one of the things. Corporations were tightly controlled at that time, but I'm not suggesting it was the land of milk and honey for workers. Or, by the way, poor white folks who came as indentured servants, right? I mean, it was not... the corporation was not used, but slavery was. And that's how the ruling elite actually kept us cowed and under control. So these state legislative laws began to be stripped away just before, and especially during the Civil War. But that wasn't enough to do it just at the state legislative level. Then the U.S. Supreme Court, who Who elects the Supreme Court again? Who did you vote for, Bill? We're close friends. You'd be willing to tell me.
Don Blankenship.
That is to say, the unelected and virtually unaccountable Supreme Court said, no, a corporation is not going to be considered a public entity with duties that are accountable to government and the people. A corporation needs to be considered a person with actual rights. It perverts the entire premise of a democratic republic. Corporate personhood is not just a legal theory. It is not just a law. It is a bedrock legal doctrine by which the wealthy elite are then able to strip our authority to rule ourselves away from us. And they use the legal system against us to legitimize that theft. That's what corporate personhood means. So if we're going to have a functioning democracy, yeah, you can applaud. If we're going to have a functioning democracy, we got to abolish corporate personhood. We have to. We have to. Because it's preventing us from creating the society that we want and deserve to live in. And in January of this year, and thank you, Lois, for that introduction where you were able to describe Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, where the Supreme Court overturned the anemic campaign finance laws afforded us by McCain-Feingold. Let's remember that in 2008, with McCain-Feingold in effect, how many billion with the B, was spent in 2008? Was it $1 billion? No. $2 billion? No. $3 billion? No. How many, sir? You said it. Say it. $5 billion with a B was spent. Pardon me. Squandered. And I say squandered very sincerely, because if that $5 billion had actually been spent to host town hall meetings for people from the left and the right and the middle to come together and debate one another and have civil discourse, I would say what a well-spent $5 billion that was to create processes of democracy and deliberation and dialogue. And not that we're going to all agree, but at least create mechanisms by which we can have those kinds of conversations. That would be a well-spent $5 billion. But it wasn't spent on that, was it? It was spent on 30-second sound bites. Sound and fury signifying nothing.
Feeding the media
The media.
The corporations that own them.
It's true what you say. It's a truth teller in our midst as well. Feeding the media that control the very candidates, and it's nothingness. It's absolutely absurd what those 30-second sound bites were. Whether you supported Barack Obama or not, those 30-second sound bites did nothing to help to create democratic dialogue. Whether you supported John McCain or not, those 30-second sound bites did not do anything to engage discourse. They were not helpful. And even further, how many schools might we have built with $5 billion? How many hospitals might have been built? How many plants, alternative sustainable energy plants, creating localized energy might have been built in this country with $5 billion? It was squandered, folks. It was absolutely squandered. So those anemic law protections afforded by the McCain-Feingold law, the Supreme Court said no, that those are, and they used words and language suggesting that corporations were an oppressed minority. Read that opinion. If you think you're mad now, read Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. It is outrageous. And they say, no, corporations have First Amendment rights to speak, and don't forget, we, the unelected and unaccountable Supreme Court, already said that money is speech, and therefore spending of money is political speech, when it is not. Money is property. It's not speech. That's patently obvious. So the Supreme Court in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission says, we're going to overturn McCain-Feingold, and we're going to allow, in future elections, corporate money to be used for independent expenditures in an unlimited basis. So if you think it was bad now, watch out. The floodgates are open. Not all, let's just tell the truth. Cut to the chase. The Supreme Court has legalized bribery. They have legalized bribery, and even deeper, they've legalized corporate extortion. Think of it this way. Let's say Greg Coleridge is a member of the U.S. Congress representing Ohio, and I am the Chamber of Commerce, and I have heard that Greg Coleridge is contemplating introducing a pretty sweeping labor bill. And his bill is not only going to create an actual minimum wage, and raise it to a living wage, but he wants to dismantle the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he wants to dismantle the U.S. participation in the World Trade Organization. And he wants to take U.S. money out of the International Monetary Fund. And I, as a champ, you're going to pull out Congressman Greg Coleridge. But as the representative for the Chamber of Commerce, I'd like to talk to the good congressman and say, Congressman, you have the right to introduce bills, any bill that you ultimately decide to do. But I've got a problem with the bill that I'm hearing you're going to introduce. So if you are willing to just meet with me and my staff of lobbyists to come up with a compromise bill, would you be willing to do that, Congressman Coleridge?
No.
No. We know. He says no. Then I'll spend $500,000 against you. I'll spend $1 million against you. I'll spend $2 million, $3 million, $5 million. See, I get to keep saying numbers until his eyes get wide or he blinks. Under the campaign finance laws of McCain-Feingold, that would have been illegal. Now it's perfectly legal. So when I say legalizing corporate bribery, I mean it. When I say legalizing...
All right. Go to the website called Move to Amend to find out more and to get involved in the movement to amend the Constitution to get rid of corporate personhood.
Represent you or corporate money? Because that's really the question of the day. Who is going to rule? People or money? And I'm standing with the people, and I hope you are too. Peace.
You are listening to WRUW FM 91.1 Cleveland, broadcasting from the campus of Case Western Reserve University. It's time for Domestic Decay.